Welcome back to the program. My guest, Lori Rubin, was born blind, but has never allowed herself to be defined by her disability. She's an internationally celebrated mezzo-soprano, a jewelry designer, a water skier, and a graduate of Yale. She's also the author of a new memoir and CD, both entitled Do You Dream in Color? It is my pleasure to welcome Lori Rubin to the program today to talk about Do You Dream in Color? Lori, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. One of the things that is so powerfully clear in what you write about in your memoir, Do You Dream in Color, is really how your parents, from literally the diagnosis forward, did everything possible to make your life as normal as possible.
Yeah, no, that is right. I mean, I was very lucky that my parents stepped forward, and it was really funny because when I first got my diagnosis at 3 months old, the way they got proactive was to buy a 1979 Chevy van. And people might say, that's a strange way to be proactive, but I think what it was for them is they wanted me to experience the world with the four senses I did have. So they took me on camping trips from as early as I can remember, and even prior to that, going to Santa Barbara, to the El Capitan Beach, to Sequoia, everywhere in California, Lake Tahoe. And most of those trips I don't remember because I was around 9 months old. but it did start early, and there was one time where they tell me that there was a call of bear. There was a bear sighting, and my brother was like hiding under the bed, and I was like, I want to pet the bear. So we did have quite some adventures at an early age, but they always wanted me to do as much as they were as I was able to do, and that included skiing when I was old enough to ski, and I eventually started skiing. And now I don't know how I did this because I have much more fear than I did when I was a kid. But I skied the Black Diamond runs with them.
And you also took up water skiing.
Yeah, well, when I was actually very close with Kenny Loggins, because right. It was a long story and the book goes into that. But there was one time where we used to sort of tour with him a lot, and we'd go on excursions with him and his family. We became sort of those shameless groupies. But there was one time that we were on a speedboat with him, and my brother was going to go water skiing. And then, you know, I said, well, I want to go water skiing too. And, you know, Kenny was on the boat, and he heard that. And he arranged for me to get an instructor on board, and that's how I learned to water ski at that point.
And Kenny Loggins, your mother met in a supermarket.
That's right. Because we lived in Encino, California, which is a suburb, sort of in the San Fernando Valley, so I'm definitely a Valley girl. But at the time, Kenny Loggins was living there, not too far from where we lived, and he was at the market in the butcher section, and so was my mom, and she could barely believe it because all she did was listen to his music all the time, so in the car, everywhere, and she knew that I loved his music, so... when she told him about us, he just, you know, he invited us backstage to his next concert, and it just sort of snowballed from there.
You also listened to a lot of classical music, which your father played a lot of.
That's right. Wow, yeah, he did. And because we had a stereo system, and he was sort of into gadgets, so he would just play things on the stereo. And I think that there was this wonderful landscape of sound that I was really sort of stimulated by, and it would just fill the entire house. And when you play classical music, especially in the 80s, that was what really showcased the speakers, and that was my first sort of introduction to sort of Beethoven's Fifth, and we even had Hooked on Classics. So a lot of those different sort of classical hits were sort of introduced to me at a very early age.
And later on, you continued your love of music, and you dealt with it in many ways, not through sight, obviously, but through feel and understanding the instruments and the sounds.
Yeah, that's right. I had a music teacher at my school for the blind. Her name was Carol Tavis, and she was just this wonderful teacher. I'll never forget Mrs. Tavis. And she wanted all of her... This is at the school for the blind, so she really wanted all of her students to interact with the instruments in a very tactile way, so that when we would go see an orchestra, we would understand the music would just come alive. It wouldn't just be we're listening to an orchestra. It would, oh, wow, you know, this is what an orchestra is doing, and I could actually visualize what the tuba player was doing or the trumpet player. And it's also neat to see how people make sounds on the various different instruments. It was a really great education. And I think, you know, that was such an important time for me because I went to a school for the blind, you know, in downtown Los Angeles, which was so far away from my home. So my identity was in question because my brother was sort of going to a neighborhood school. We were Jewish, so he went to his neighborhood Jewish day school, and mm-hmm. I just felt very different, and there were all these other kids, you know, not that I didn't get along with them, but some of them were just at very different levels than I was in terms of some of them were developmentally disabled. Some of the ones that were more like me in sort of in terms of our abilities were if, you know, they lived far away, so I couldn't have play dates with them necessarily. So it was just really, I think music was actually where I felt a lot of my identity came together, and I could be myself when I was listening to music or sort of interacting with instruments, because that I knew I really enjoyed. I knew that I was going to be a musician.
And how did you know, and how did your gifts and your talents musically begin to evolve?
Well, you know, when I was about 4 years old, I started taking piano lessons, but typical, I think, of many classical singers, I decided that I wasn't going to practice or it just wasn't for me. And so when my piano teacher would come over and play new pieces for me to learn, I would just sing along. And she eventually just recommended that I take voice lessons, which was probably her way of saying, oh, I'm not dealing with this anymore. And, but, you know, actually, she and my grandmother, my grandparents, you know, had said the same thing because my grandparents were another reason I would listen to opera. They would play it all the time, and I would sort of sing along, and at a very early age sort of had an affinity for that operatic sound, and so they were like, you know, maybe Lori should take voice lessons. And when I was around 11 years old, I started, but, you know, it's sort of the default is pop for any teacher to teach their kid, to teach their students, and then when I saw Phantom of the Opera a year later, my teacher... I came back into my lesson and I said to her, I was totally mesmerized. And I said, you know, I really want to sing the part of Christine. And so I started learning that style, that sort of more operatic style. And my teacher was thrilled because she was a Juilliard alum in opera. So she started teaching me all her favorite classical stuff that was appropriate for my age. And when I was in high school, or junior high school, I think that's when it really took effect because I wanted to fit in somewhere, and I think in middle school I was so different. I used to come to class with a computer, a huge laptop computer on my back, and, you know, this was the early 90s, so these were these huge Toshiba things that were, you know, 25 pounds, and I was an eyesore with that and my cane when, you know, kids were using streamlined devices like pens and pencils at the time. Nobody was using a MacBook Pro or anything, you know, so... I was definitely not cool, and then my love of classical music made me even less cool. And so I really found my niche when I would do, like, I was part of the California All-State Honor Choir full of high school students who loved to sing in choir, and that included classical music. So when we were singing together, that's how we bonded. And I think also singing gave kids a sense that I was normal, because if I could sing like they could, it didn't matter that I was blind. I was still communicating through this very powerful, this sort of genre, you know, and music being was so, it was just so important in helping me bond with the other kids. It didn't matter what your race was, didn't matter what your disability was. We were just all connected through music.
And this all came together at a critical time because middle school was, it is for most girls, but particularly in your situation, it was a very difficult period.
Oh, definitely. You know, the kids at school were, you know, I thought they were my friends, but then they wouldn't find me at lunch, and it was just very isolating, so I ended up sitting at lunch by myself. You know, some of the boys were very bullying in a way. They would say mean things, and, you know, it was just a hard time, and of course, you know, I was so self-conscious about my identity, being blind, and, you know, anything that made me feel different, you know, was very damaging. And when I was in eighth grade, this actually was in the book, but it was so depressing that my editor had to cut it, was this chapter about how I had this very close family friend who had to accompany me on a trip because my the teachers wanted me to have a special chaperone on this the school trip to Catalina, even though this was like having your own chaperone was like having a scarlet A on your chest. Mm-hmm. It was just not something that was cool. But I remember it was okay because she was this close family friend that was sort of like a sister to me. She was just over 18, so she was still in the cool category. But she told me one day that I would never have a normal life. I would never have a job. I would never, she said that it would be a burden on my family my entire life. And, you know, I just was devastated to hear all of this. And she said, this is why kids don't want to be friends with me, because they just can't relate to somebody who's so going to be so isolated in the world. And, you know, for the longest time, I internalized that and it scarred me. But then I realized as I got older that you can't let somebody identify you. You can't let somebody tell you who you think you're going to be, who they think you're going to be. You're the only one who can define yourself and see your beautiful qualities. And then as you get older and you have this wonderful life and you pursue that for yourself, you realize that none of that is true. And so bullying and all of that kind of stuff is a big thing for me. And I try to, when I talk to young kids and read my book to teenagers, I always focus on how my life at the time was so difficult, but then how now it's so wonderful, and they should learn from that and not to judge the rest of their lives by middle school and high school. And, I've sung for them and read for them, and there have been definitely those kids that it reaches and touches, and they cry, and they, you know, I think they can relate. And especially through music, which is such a powerful means of expression, I think that really helps them, and it helps me.
Talk a little bit about your learning to read and read music. And in fact, when you learned to read through Braille, you learned eventually in multiple languages.
Yeah, well, when I learned to read Braille, that's when the other kids, you know, who would be sighted were at the same age, were learning to read print. So there was never a question for me that it was hard. Like, you know, people always ask, was Braille hard? And I say, well, no, because my brain was in that critical learning stage where I could soak up things. And so Braille was just my means of writing. And as I got older, being Jewish, you know, I was considering having a bat mitzvah. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it wasn't even a question for my family because my brother was bar mitzvah and everybody sort of in our circle was. One of the things I had to learn was Hebrew. And so that really meant that I had to find a Braille tutor, basically a blind person who knew Hebrew in Braille. And the Jewish Braille Institute in New York is a wonderful organization because they Braille or they make all materials accessible to students, especially Jewish students. And they were really what made me on an equal playing field with my sighted students in Hebrew school, because they Brailled everything that I needed. Mm-hmm. And then when it was my time for my bat mitzvah, I got all of my stuff Brailled for my bat mitzvah, the Siddur, the Torah portion, the Haftarah, all of the things I would need came from the Jewish Braille. And there were about 600 people at my bar mitzvah, which is very uncharacteristic. It's usually the people you invite. But I think there was a curiosity thing, and everybody had found it out that the first blind bat mitzvah at Valley Beth Shalom was going to take place. And so everybody came, and I can remember the scraping of chairs, you know, because everybody wanted to watch. I was going to learn Hebrew. But anyway, so what ended up happening was that later in life, this came in really handy because I had to learn, different languages, Italian and French, as I was in the conservatory and various different programs. And then I eventually learned how to do to read Braille Russian. So that was really, really important because when I was at Yale, I had a teacher who insisted that I was going to be in the Russian diction class like everyone else, and which was great. And then I happened to know a pianist who was Russian, and so I had her tell me how to learn Russian Braille, which is very different. And I got to sing Tchaikovsky songs that year, and it's not many people know how to sing in Russian at all, but so to have that and to learn Russian Cyrillic was really important.
Talk a little bit about the merging of color and music and how you put the two together.
You know, I think a lot of people have what's called synesthesia. And this, you know, you read about this a lot, mm-hmm, in treatises, ever since the classic period for music. And there's one in particular talks about how color and music go together and how, for example, I mean, I think everybody's idea of what color things are is different, but for me, the key of A is is green, or an F sharp minor would be yellow. And I'm trying to think what else. B flat would be chocolate. And for me, G, the key of G, especially in the Mixolydian mode for some reason, is blue. And I think it probably has something to do with when you're younger and you are associating sounds with other experiences, you start to think, oh, okay, well, because I was outside one day when I was a year and a half and something in A major was playing, that's green or something. You know, it's really interesting. But, yeah, I definitely associate color with music. And when I make jewelry, color is really such an important part of my life, and I think about it musically. So it's very interesting how that happens.
Talk about the jewelry and how you came to that.
Jewelry is something that I've always loved because it's a style that a blind person can tactilely interact with. And so I think for me, I could feel the metalwork around a ring setting or a bracelet or what have you. Just tell what people, you know, what's funky or what was conservative or whatnot. And when I was in New York in 2006 and I was just trying to find my way, just as anybody does when you come out of grad school and you move to New York, jewelry was something that became sort of like a little bit of a lucrative side business for me because I had a friend of my mother's who was showing me the bracelets that she made in a jewelry class, and she said even though she could see, she did most of it by feel. So inspired me to take some jewelry making classes at the JCC, the Jewish Community Center there, because I lived two blocks away. And I actually had an instructor from the JCC teach me privately. So I did that for a few months, and she was very patient with showing me how the tools work. And she found alternate ways of, instead of having to see it, like how I could feel it and not to get in the way with my fingers. And it was very, very cool because then I could go to town and I could go to bead stores and pick out things by texture, not only by color, but by texture, and put things together, you know, that I felt worked well proportionally based on how it felt. And color, you know, helped because, you know, for years, I mean, I am my mother's daughter, so I've, you know, been listening to her tell me what colors work well together. And so I would make things with unusual color combinations just based on what I knew of various things that would go together. And so, therefore, I started making my own statements through jewelry.
Have there ever been times when you've been angry about your disability or felt particularly sorry for yourself, other than perhaps when your backpack wasn't the right color?
Definitely. I mean, I think, we all kind of feel sorry for ourselves about one thing or another. I try not to. I think for me, it's more how other people have related to my disability, how other people have felt about blindness. And so therefore, like, for example, like, my parents never, one of the things that they weren't as good about as letting me do things for myself. I mean, they were wonderful at making sure I was integrated in a private school, and they were wonderful at making sure that I learned to type and that I was going to have a career and to integrate me in that way. But, you know, the tendency is logistically, and this is very characteristic of lots of parents of blind people, is to do things for your blind child. But what you realize is that we all want, I think, over and above everything else, you want dignity. And so it's really important to teach a blind person to be physically independent, like learning how to cut and learning how to pour, because you don't want to be set apart and have other people do things for you. And also, if you learn how to do it when you're younger, your motor skills at that age are being developed, so you want to make sure you learn it young so that by the time you get to be an adult, things like cutting aren't difficult or awkward. And so I think that I've always, like, when people would go on trips and everybody would be carrying things or everybody would be helping in the kitchen and they just had me sit on the sidelines, that's when I started to feel resentful of how people treated my disability. And I wanted to show that I could be valuable and I could do things, not only in the regular world, but in the work world, but in terms of my community and family. And I think of the other times I've been resentful, or not resentful, but, you know, felt sorry for myself. As, let's say, you know, like any other singer, if you don't get a role, you think, oh, I wish I could have gotten that. But there's that added layer of people thinking, in auditions that, yes, I have a great, perfect voice for the role, but how am I going to move around on stage? And they walk around with their preconceived notions, and they don't, you know, find out how I could possibly move around on stage. And they don't even know that I walk around my own house or that I do email. You know, so I always tell people that it's not so much that I'm upset or feel sorry about being blind, but I feel sorry for myself when I realize that other people are treating me differently. And I'm like, and, you know, I get really irritated. But, you know, I think that we all have our little, you know, moments. And I really, for the most part, I just try to educate people. And, you know, my parents have always told me, Lori, your job is going to be to educate people. And sometimes I go, well, I wish I wouldn't have to do that all the time. You know, I wish I could just be myself and people would just take my word for it that I'm normal, you know. But most of the time I'm very patient and happy to educate. And because I realize that once I educate people, then they're going to stop, you know, having these ideas about me. So.
And you're going to be doing this event here in the Bay Area, here in San Francisco at Temple Emmanuel as part of the Meyer Concert Series on January 14th and 15th. Tell us mm-hmm. a little about that.
The concert is, it's wonderful. Actually, it's really special because it's the 10th anniversary of this series at Temple Emmanuel. And Frederica von Stade inaugurated the series with a concert 10 years ago. So she's actually going to be there. And she's been a wonderful friend and mentor to me over the last, I would say, 15 years or so. And she's going to be performing with me, but also hosting and emceeing, and she's just such a lovely person. And, you know, she is so beloved in the Bay Area. Of course, she's loved internationally, but especially because she's been so philanthropic and she's lived in the Bay Area for so many years. I think it'll just be very special for her to be at this concert. And I will be, in terms of what I'll be singing, is I'll be singing the title track of my CD, which I just found out just last week that it was just rated among the best of 2012 in the American Record Guide, which was completely surreal and shocking to me, but certainly I was really excited. But anyway, I'll be doing the title track of that CD, and it's really about my life as a blind person. It's sort of a detour through my life, and it's sort of everything that I would want to express to people about what my life is like, including sharing with them that I want the benefit of the doubt of being treated like a normal person. And I'll also be doing some musical theater and pop. So, and one of the things that I do in my concerts is I always sort of tell the audience stories about my life and relate it to the music, because I think nowadays people have lost the recital, the tradition appreciation, which is, you know, the coming on stage, not clapping in between songs. A lot of people find that something that they can't really relate to. So I think one of the things that they, that I like to do is tell stories between songs, especially like musical theater songs, because I want them to, you know, to relate the music to their own lives, but also to know how it relates to my life. And it kind of, it breaks the ice, and there's this wonderful feeling that happens between audience and singer where it's no longer, there's no longer this huge distance between it, but it's like we're all having a wonderful conversation and night of music together. And whether you're in a 375-seat hall or somebody's living room, you can always make the audience feel very at home and comfortable. And so that's really what my concerts have really become over the years.
Lori Rubin, her memoir and CD is Do You Dream in Color? The event we were talking about is January 14th and 15th at Temple Emmanuel. Lori, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate it. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.